people interested in him, girls from his own background. He was a pretty boy with a lot of family money. Well, said Una, look at little cousin Cynthia lurking in the wings.
Did you know Cynthia? Asked Robin.
Met her once or twice at their house, mousy little thing. She never spoke more than two words to me, said Una, but she made Roy feel good about himself, laughing like a drain at all his jokes, such as they were.
Margot and Roy must have married right after medical school, did they?
That's right. I was a bridesmaid. She went into general practice. Roy was a high flyer. He went into one of the big teaching hospitals. I can't remember which. Roy's parents had this very nice big house with huge lawns and all the rest of it. After his father died, which was just before they had Anna, the mother made it over to Roy. Margot's name wasn't on the deeds. I remember her telling me that. But Roy loved the idea of bringing up his family in the same house he'd grown up in, and it was beautiful, right enough, out near Hampton Court. So the mother-in-law moved out, and Roy and Margot moved in. Except, of course, the mother-in-law felt she had the right to walk back in any time she felt like it, because she'd given it to them, and she still looked on it as more hers than Margot's.
"Did you and Margot still see a lot of each other?"
asked Robin. "We did," said Una.
"We used to try and meet at least once every couple of weeks. Real best friends we were. Even after she married Roy, she wanted to hold on to me. They had their middle-class friends, of course, but I think," said Una, her voice thickening.
"I think she knew I'd always be on her side, you see. She was moving in circles where she felt alone."
"At home or at work, too?" asked Robin.
"At home she was a fish out of water," said Una. "Roy's house, Roy's family, Roy's friends, Roy's everything. She saw her own mammy and daddy plenty, but it was hard, the daddy being in his wheelchair, to get him out to the big house. I think the Bamboroughs felt intimidated by Roy and his mother. So Margot used to go back to Stepney to see them. She was still supporting him financially. Ran herself ragged between all her different commitments."
"And how were things at work?"
"Uphill all the way," said Una. "There weren't that many women doctors back then. And she was young and working class, and that practice she ended up at, the St. John's one, she felt alone." "It wasn't a happy place," said Una, echoing Dr. Gupta. "Being Margot, she wanted to try and make it better. That was Margot's whole ethos. Make it better. Make it work. Look after everyone. Solve the problem. She tried to bring them together as a team, even though she was the one being bullied."
"Who was bullying her?"
"The old fella," said Una. "I can't remember the names now. There were two other doctors, isn't that right? The old one and the Indian one. She said he was all right, the Indian fella, but she could feel the disapproval of him, too. They had an argument about the pill, she told me. GPs could give it to unmarried women if they wanted. When it was first brought out, it was married women only. But the Indian lad, he still wouldn't hand it out to unmarried women. The first family planning clinic started appearing the same year Margot disappeared. We talked about them. Margot said, thank God for it, because she was sure women coming to their clinic weren't able to get it from either of the other doctors."
"But it wasn't only them. She had trouble with the other staff. I don't think the nurse liked her either."
"Janice?" said Robin.
"Was it Janice?" said Una, frowning.
"Irene," suggested Strike.
"She was blonde," said Una. "I remember, at the Christmas party."
"You were there?"
said Robin, surprised.
"Margot begged me to go," said Una. "She'd set it up, and she was afraid it was going to be awful. Roy was working, so he couldn't go. This was just a few months after Anna was born. Margot had been on maternity leave, and they'd got another doctor in to cover for her, a man. She was convinced a place had worked better without her. She was hormonal and tired and dreading going back. Anna would only have been 2 or 3 months old. Margot brought her to the party because she was breastfeeding. She'd organised the Christmas party to try and make a bit of a fresh start with them all, break the ice before she had to go back in." "Go on about Irene," said Robin,
conscious of Strike's pen hovering over his notebook.
"Well, she got drunk, if she's the blonde one. She brought some man with her to the party. Anyway, towards the end of the night, Irene accused Margot of flirting with the man. Did you ever in your life hear anything more ridiculous? There is Margot, standing there with a new baby in her arms and a girl having a proper go at her. Was she not the nurse? It's so long ago.
No, Irene was the receptionist, said Robin.
I thought that was a little Italian girl.
Gloria was the other one.
Oh, Margot loved her, said Una. She said the girl was very clever but in a bad situation. She never gave me details. I think the girl had seen her for medical advice, and of course, Margot wouldn't have shared anything about her health. She took all of that very seriously. No priest in his confessional treated other people's secrets with more respect.
I want to ask you about something sensitive, said Robin tentatively. There was a book about Margot, written in 1985, and you joined with Roy to stop it, Una said at once.
I did. It was a pack of lies from start to finish. You know what he wrote, obviously, about...
Una might have left the Catholic Church, but she balked at the word.
Determination. It was a filthy lie. I never had an abortion, and nor did Margot. She'd have told me if she was thinking about it. We were best friends. Somebody used her name to make that appointment, I don't know who. The clinic didn't recognise her picture. She'd never been there. The very best thing in her life was Anna, and she'd never have got rid of another baby. Never. She wasn't religious, but she'd have thought that was a sin, all right.
She wasn't a churchgoer, Robin asked.
Atheist, true and true, said Una. She thought it was all superstition. Her mammy was chapel, and Margot reacted against it. The church kept women down, was the way Margot looked at it. And she said to me, if there's a God, why do my daddy, who's a good man, have to fall off that stepladder? Why's my family have to live the life we've had? Well, Margot couldn't tell me anything about hypocrisy and religion I didn't already know. I'd left the Catholics by then. Doctrine of papal infallibility. No contraception, no matter if women died having their 11th. My own mammy thought she was God's deputy on this earth, so she did. And some of the nuns at my school were pure bitches. Sister Mary Teresa, see there, said Una, pushing her fringe out of her eyes to reveal a scar the size of a 5-pence piece. She hit me round the head with a metal set square, blood everywhere. I expect you deserved it, Mammy said. Now, I'll tell you who reminded me of Sister Mary Teresa, said Una. Would she have been the nurse now, the older one at Margot's practice?
Do you mean Dorothy?
She was a widow, the one I'm thinking of.
Yes, that was Dorothy, the secretary.
Spit image of Sister Mary Teresa, the eyes on her, said Una. I got cornered by her at the party. They're drawn to the church, women like that. Nearly every congregation's got a couple. Outward observance, inward poison. They say the words, you know, Father, forgive me for I have sinned. But the Dorothys of this world, they don't believe they can sin. Not really. One thing life's taught me. Where there's no capacity for joy, there's no capacity for goodness, said Una Kennedy. She had it in for Margot, that Dorothy. I told her I was Margot's best friend, and she started asking nosy questions. How we'd met, boyfriends, how Margot met Roy, none of her bloody business. Then she started talking about the old doctor, whatever his name was. There was a bit of Sister Mary Teresa in her, all right. But that woman's God was sitting a desk away. I told Margot about the talk I'd had with her afterwards. And Margot said I was right. Dorothy was a mean one.
It was Dorothy's son who wrote the book about Margot, said Robin.
Was it her son? Gasped Una. Was it? Well, there you are. Nasty pieces of work, the pair of 'em.
When was the last time you saw Margot? Robin asked.
Exactly 2 weeks before the night she disappeared. We met at the Three Kings then, too. 6 o'clock, I had a night off from the club. There were a couple of bars nearer to practice, but she didn't want to run into anyone she worked with after hours.
Can you remember what you talked about that night?
I remember everything, said Una. You'll think that's an exaggeration, but it isn't. I started by giving her a row about going for a drink with Satchwell, which she told me about on the phone. They'd bumped into each other in the street. She said he seemed different to how he used to be, and that worried me, I'm not going to lie. She wasn't built for an affair, but she was unhappy. Once we got to the pub, she told me the whole story. He'd asked to see her again, and she said no, I believed her, and I'll tell you why. Because she looked so damn miserable that she'd said no. She seemed worn down that night, unhappy like I'd never seen her before. She said Roy hadn't been talking to her for 10 days when she ran into Satchwell. They'd had a row about his mother walking in and out of the house like she owned it. Margot wanted to redecorate, but Roy said it'd break his mother's heart if they got rid of any of the things his father loved. So there was Margot, an outsider in her own home, not even allowed to change the ornaments. Margot said she had a line from Caught and Spark running through her head all day long. Joni Mitchell's album, Caught and Spark, she said, seeing Robin's puzzlement. That was Margot's religion. Joni Mitchell. She raved about that album. It was a line from the song The Same Situation. Caught in my struggle for higher achievements and my search for love that don't seem to cease. I can't listen to that album to this day. It's too painful. She told me she went straight home after having the drink with Paul and told Roy what had just happened. I think partly she felt guilty about going for the drink, but partly she wanted to jolt him awake. She was tired and miserable, and she was saying, "Someone else wanted me once." Human nature, isn't it? "Wake up," she was saying. "You can't just ignore me and cut me off and refuse all compromises. I can't live like this." Well, being Roy, he wasn't the type to fire up and start throwing things. I think she'd have found it easier if he had. He was furious, all right, but he showed it by getting colder and more silent. I don't think he said another word to her until the day she disappeared. She told me on the phone when we arranged a drink for the 11th. "I'm still living in a silent order." She sounded hopeless. I remember thinking then, she's going to leave him. When we met in the pub that last time, I said to her, "Satchwell's not the answer to whatever's wrong with you and Roy." We talked about Anna too. Margot would have given anything to take a year or two out and concentrate on Anna. And that's exactly what Roy and his mother had wanted her to do, stay home with Anna and forget working. But she couldn't. She was still supporting her parents. Her mammy was ill now, and Margot didn't want her out cleaning houses anymore. While she was working, she could look Roy in the face and justify all the money she was giving him. But his mother wasn't going to let her precious, delicate son work for the benefit of a pair of chain-smoking EastEnders. "Can you remember anything else you talked about?" "We talked about the Playboy Club, because I was leaving. I'd got me flat and I was thinking of going and studying. Margot was all for it. What I didn't tell her was, I was thinking of a theology degree. What with her attitude to religion. We talked about politics a bit. We both wanted Wilson to win the election. And I told her I was worried I still hadn't found the one. Over 30 I was. That was old then, for finding a husband. Before we said goodbye that night, I said, 'Don't forget, there's always a spare room at my place. Room for a bassinet as well.'" Tears welled again in Una's eyes and trickled down her cheeks. She picked up her napkin and pressed it to her face. "I'm sorry. 40 years ago, but it feels like yesterday. They don't disappear, the dead. It'd be easier if they did. I can see her so clearly. If she walked up those steps now, part of me wouldn't be surprised. She was such a vivid person. For her to disappear like that, just thin air where she was." Robin said nothing until Una had wiped her face dry, then asked, "What can you remember about arranging to meet on the 11th? "She called me, asked to meet same place, same time. I said, 'Yes, of course.' There was something funny in the way she said it. I said, 'Everything all right?' She said, 'I need to ask your advice about something. I might be going mad. I shouldn't really talk about it, but I think you're the only one I can trust.'" Strike and Robin looked at each other. "Was that not written down anywhere?"
"No," said Strike.
"No," said Una. And for the first time she looked angry. "Well, I can't say I'm surprised."
"Why not?"
asked Robin.
"Talbot was away with the fairies," said Una. "I could see it in the first 5 minutes of my interview. I called Roy. I said, 'That man isn't right. Complain. Tell him you want someone else on the case.' He didn't.
or if he did, nothing was done. And Lawson thought I was some silly little bunny girl, said Una. Probably thought I was telling fibs, trying to make myself interesting off the back of my best friend disappearing. Margot Bamborough was more like a sister than a friend to me, said Una fiercely. And the only person I've ever really talked to about her is my husband. I cried all over him 2 days before we got married, because she should have been there. She should have been my matron of honour.
Have you got any idea what she was going to ask your advice about? Asked Robin.
No, said Una. I've thought about it often since, whether it could have had anything to do with what happened. Something about Roy, perhaps. But then why would she say she shouldn't talk about it? We'd already talked about Roy. I told her as plain as I could the last time we met she could come and live with me if she left Anna as well. Then I thought maybe it's something a patient had told her, because, like I said, she was scrupulous about confidentiality. Anyway, I walked up that hill in the rain to the pub on the 11th. I was early, so I went to have a look at that church there, over the road, big, white, said Strike sharply. What kind of coat were you wearing?
Una didn't seem surprised by the question. On the contrary, she smiled.
You're thinking of the old gravedigger, or whoever he was, the one who thought he saw Margot going in there.
I told them at the time it was me, said Una. I wasn't wearing a raincoat, but it was beige. My hair was darker than Margot's, but it was the same kind of length. I told them, when they asked me, did I think Margot might have gone into the church before meeting me? I said, no, she hated church. I went there. That was me.
Why? Asked Strike. Why did you go in there?
I was being called, said Una simply.
Robin repressed a smile, because Strike looked almost embarrassed at the answer.
God was calling me back, said Una. I kept going into Anglican churches thinking, is this the answer? There was so much about the Catholics I couldn't take, but still, I could feel the pull back towards him.
How long do you think you were in the church? Asked Robin, to give Strike time to recover himself.
5 minutes or so. I said a little prayer. I was asking for guidance. Then I walked out again, crossed the road, and went into the pub. I waited nearly the full hour before I called Roy. At first I thought, she's been delayed by a patient. Then I thought, no, she must have forgotten. But when I called the house, Roy said she wasn't there. He was quite short with me. I wondered whether something more had happened between them. Maybe Margot had snapped.
Maybe I was going to get home and find her on the doorstep with Anna. So I went dashing home, but she wasn't there.
Roy called at 9 to see whether I'd had any contact. That's when I started to get really worried. He said he was going to call the police.
You'll know the rest, said Una quietly. It was like a nightmare. You put all your hopes on things that are less and less likely. Amnesia, knocked down by a car and unconscious somewhere. She's run away somewhere to think. But I knew, really. She'd never have left her baby girl, and she'd never have left without telling me. I knew she was dead. I could tell the police thought it was the Essex butcher, but me.
But you? Prompted Robin gently.
Well, I kept thinking, 3 weeks after Paul Satchwell comes back into her life, she vanishes forever. I know he had his little alibi, all his arty friends backing him up. I said to Talbot and Lawson, ask him about the pillow dream. Ask him what that means. The pillow dream he was so frightened Margot would tell people about.
Is that in the police notes? She asked Strike,
turning to look at him.
Did either of them ask Satchwell about the pillow dream?
No, said Strike slowly. I don't think they did.
Chapter 25. All those were idle thoughts and fantasies, deuces, dreams, opinions unsound, shoes, visions, soothsays and prophecies, and all that feigned is as leasings, tales and lies. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. 3 evenings later,
Strike was to be found sitting in his BMW outside a nondescript terraced house in Stoke Newington. The Shifty investigation, now in its fifth month, had so far yielded no results. The restive trustees, who suspected that their CEO was being blackmailed by the ambitious Shifty, were making ominous noises of discontent and were clearly considering taking their business elsewhere. Even after being plied with gin by Hutchins, who'd succeeded in befriending him at the Rifle Club, Shifty had remained as close-lipped as ever about the hold he had over his boss. So it was time, Stryker decided, to start tailing SB himself. It was just possible that the CEO, a rotund pinstripe man with a bald patch like a monk's tonsure, was still indulging in the blackmailable behaviour that Shifty had uncovered, and that had leveraged him into a promotion that neither Shifty's CV nor his personality justified. Strike was sure Shifty wasn't exploiting a simple case of infidelity. Espy's current wife had the immaculate plastic sheen of a doll newly removed from cellophane, and Strike suspected it would take more than her husband having an affair to make her relinquish her taloned grip on a Black American Express card, especially as she'd been married barely 2 years and had no children to guarantee a generous settlement. Christmas tree lights twinkled in almost every window surrounding Strike. The roof of the house beside him had been hung with brilliant blue-white icicles that burned the retina if looked at too long. Wreaths on doors, glass panels decorated with fake snow, and the sparkle of orange, red and green, reflected in the dirty puddles, all reminded Strike that he really did need to start buying Christmas gifts to take to Cornwall. Joan had been released from hospital that morning, her drugs adjusted, and determined to get home and start preparing for the family festivities. Strike would need to buy presents not only for Joan and Ted, but for his sister, brother-in-law, and nephews. This was an irksome extra chore, given the amount of work the agency currently had on its books. Then he reminded himself that he had to buy something for Robin, too, something better than flowers. Strike, who disliked shopping in general, and buying gifts in particular, reached for his cigarettes to ward off a dim sense of persecution. Having lit up, Strike took from his pocket the copy of Whatever Happened to Margot Bamborough, which Robin had given him, but which he hadn't yet had time to read. Small tags marked the places Robin thought might be of some interest to the investigation. With a quick glance at the still-closed front door of the house he was watching, Strike opened the book and skim-read a couple of pages, looking up at regular intervals to check that SB hadn't yet emerged. The first chapter, which Robin hadn't marked, but which Strike flicked through anyway, dealt summarily with Margot's childhood and adolescence. Unable to gain access to anybody with particularly clear memories of his subject, Oakden had to fall back on generalities, supposition, and a good deal of padding. Thus Strike learned that Margot Bamborough would have dreamed of leaving poverty behind, would have been caught up in the giddy atmosphere of the 1960s, and would have been aware of the possibilities for consequence-free sex offered by the contraceptive pill. Word count was boosted by the information that the miniskirt had been popularised by Mary Quant, that London was the heart of a thriving music scene, and that the Beatles had appeared on America's Ed Sullivan Show around the time of Margot's 19th birthday. Margot would have been excited by the possibilities offered to the working classes in this new egalitarian era, C.B. Oakden informed his readers. Chapter 2 ushered in Margot's arrival at the Playboy Club, and here the sense of strain that had suffused the previous chapter vanished. C.B. Oakden evidently found Playboy Bunny Margot a far more inspiring subject than Child Margot, and he devoted many paragraphs to the sense of freedom and liberation she would have felt on lacing herself tightly into her bunny costume, putting on false ears, and judiciously padding the cups of her costume to ensure that her breasts appeared of sufficient fullness to satisfy her employer's stringent demands. Writing 11 years after her disappearance, Oakden had managed to track down a couple of bunny girls who remembered Margot. Bunny Lisa, who was now married with 2 children, reminisced about having a good laugh with her and being devastated by her disappearance. Bunny Rita, who ran her own marketing business, said that she was really bright, obviously going places, and thought, It must have been dreadful for her poor family. Strike glanced up again at the front of the house into which S.B. had disappeared. Still no sign of him. Turning back to C.B. Oakden, the bored Strike skipped ahead to the first place Robin had marked as of interest. After her successful stint at the Playboy Club, the playful and flirtatious Margot found it hard to adapt to the life of a general practitioner. At least one employee at the St. John's practice says her manner was out of place in the setting of a consulting room. She didn't keep them at a proper distance. That was the trouble. She wasn't from a background that had a lot of professional people. A doctor's got to hold himself above the patients. She recommended that book, The Joy of Sex, to a woman who went to see her. I heard people in the waiting room talking about it after. Giggling, you know. A doctor shouldn't be telling people to read things like that. It reflects poorly on the whole practice. I was embarrassed for her. The one who was keen on her, the young fellow who kept coming back to see her, buying her chocolates and what have you, if she was telling people about different sex positions, you can see how men got the wrong idea, can't you? There followed several paragraphs that had clearly been cribbed from the press, covering the suicide of Steve Douthwaite's married ex-girlfriend, his sudden flight from his job, and the fact that Lawson had re-interviewed him several times. Making the most of his scant material, Oakden managed to suggest that Douthwaite had been at best disreputable, at worst dangerous, a feckless drifter and an unprincipled ladies' man, in whose vicinity women had a habit of dying or disappearing. It was with a slight snort of sudden amusement, therefore, that Strike read the words. Now calling himself Stevie Jacks, Douthwaite currently works at Butlin's Holiday Camp in Clacton-on-Sea. After glancing up again to check that S.B. hadn't yet emerged, Strike read on. Where he runs events for the campers by day and performs in the cabaret by night. His Longfellow Serenade is a particular hit with the ladies. Dark-haired Douthwaite, stroke Jacks, remains a handsome man and clearly popular with female campers. I've always liked singing, he tells me in the bar after the show. I was in a band when I was younger, but it broke up. I came to Butlin's once when I was a kid with my foster family. I always thought it looked a laugh, being a redcoat. Plenty of big-time entertainers got their start here, you know. When talk turns to Margot Bamborough, however, a very different side to this cheeky cabaret singer appears. The press wrote a load of balls. I never bought her chocolates or anything else. That was just made up to make me look like some kind of creep. I had a stomach ulcer and headaches. I'd been through a bad time. After refusing to explain why he'd changed his name, Douthwaite left the bar. His colleagues at the holiday camp expressed their shock that Stevie had been questioned by the police over the disappearance of the young doctor. He never told us anything about it, said Julie Wilkes, 22. I'm quite shocked, actually. You'd think he'd have told us. He never said Jacks wasn't his real name, either. Oakden treated his readers to a brief history of Butlin's and ended the chapter with a paragraph of speculation on the opportunities a predatory man might find at a holiday camp. Strike lit another cigarette, then flicked ahead to the second of Robin's markers, where a short passage dealt with Jules Bayliss, husband of the office cleaner turned social worker, Wilma. The only piece of new information here was that convicted rapist Bayliss had been released on bail in January 1975, a full 3 months after Margot went missing. Nevertheless, Oakden asserted that Bayliss would have got wind of the fact that Margot was trying to persuade his wife to leave him, would have been angry that the doctor was pressurizing his wife to break up the family, and would have had many criminal associations in his own community. The police, Oakden informed his readers, would have looked carefully into the movements of any of Bayliss's friends or relatives on the 11th of October. So we must conclude, he finished, anticlimactically, that no suspicious activity was uncovered. Robin's third tab marked the pages dealing with the abortion at Bride Street Nursing Home. Oakden ushered in this part of his story with considerable fanfare, informing his readers that he was about to reveal facts that had never before been made public. What followed was interesting to Strike, only in as far as it proved that an abortion had definitely taken place on the 14th of September 1974, and that the name given by the patient had been Margot Bamborough. As proof, Oakden reprinted photographs of the Bride Street medical records that had been provided by an unidentified employee of the nursing home, which had closed down in 1978. Strike supposed the unnamed employee would no longer have been fearful for their job when Oakden had come offering money for information in the 80s. The unnamed employee also told Oakden that the woman who had had the procedure didn't resemble the picture of Margot that had subsequently appeared in the papers. Oakden then posed a series of rhetorical questions that he and his foolhardy publishers appeared to think circumvented libel laws. Was it possible that the woman who had the abortion had used Margot's name with her support and consent, in which case whom might Margot have been most eager to assist? Was it not most likely that a Roman Catholic would be particularly worried about anyone finding out she had had an abortion? Was it not also the case that complications could arise from such a procedure? Might Margot have returned to the vicinity of the Bride Street nursing home on the 11th of October to visit somebody who had been readmitted to the clinic? Or to ask advice on behalf of that person? Could Margot possibly have been abducted not from Clerkenwell, but from a street or two away from Dennis Creed's basement? To which Strike answered mentally, "Nope, and you deserve to have your book pulped, pal." The string of events suggested by Oakden had clearly been put together in a determined attempt to place Margot in the vicinity of Creed's basement on the night she disappeared. Complications were necessary to explain Margot returning to the nursing home a month after the abortion, but they couldn't be Margot's own, given that she was fit, well, and working at the St. John's practice all the way up to her disappearance. Once attributed to a best friend, however, undefined complications could serve two purposes. To give Margot a reason to head back to the clinic to visit Una, and Una a reason to lie about both women's whereabouts that night. All in all, Strike considered Oakden lucky not to have been sued, and surmised that fear of the resultant publicity was all that had held Roy and Una back. He flicked forward to Robin's fourth tab, and after checking again that the front door of the house he was watching remained closed, read the next marked passage. "I saw her as clearly as I can see you now. She was standing at that window, pounding on it as if she wanted to attract attention. I especially remember because I was reading The Other Side of Midnight at the time, and just thinking about women and what they go through, you know, and I looked up and I saw her. If I close my eyes, she's there. It's like a snapshot in my head, and it's haunted me ever since, to be honest. People have said to me since, 'You're making it up,' or 'You need to let it go.' But I'm not changing my story just because other people don't believe it. What would that make me?" The small printers who then occupy the top floor of the building was run by husband and wife team Arnold and Rachel Sawyer. Police accepted their assurance that Margot Bamborough had never set foot on the premises, and that the woman seen by Mandy that night was probably Mrs. Sawyer herself, who claimed one of the windows needed to be hit to close properly. However, an odd connection between A&R Printing and Margot Bamborough went unnoticed by the police. A&R's first major printing job was for the now-closed nightclub, Drudge, the very nightclub for which Paul Satchwell, Margot's lover, had designed a risque mural. Satchwell's designs subsequently featured on flyers printed by A&R Printing, so it is likely that he and the Sawyers would have been in touch with each other. Might this suggest... "Fuck's sake," muttered Strike, turning the page and dropping his eyes to a brief paragraph Robin had marked with a thick black line. "However, ex-neighbour Wayne Truelove thinks that Paul Satchwell subsequently went abroad. He talked to me about going travelling. I don't think he was making a lot of money from his art, and after the police questioned him, he told me he was thinking of clearing out for a bit. Probably smart, going away." Robin's fifth and final tab came towards the end of the book, and after again checking that SB's car was parked where he had left it, and that the front door of the house had not opened, Strike read, "A month after Margot's disappearance, her husband Roy visited the St. John's practice. Roy, who had been unable to conceal his bad temper at the practice barbecue that summer, was unsurprisingly subdued on this visit. Dorothy remembers, "He wanted to speak to us all, to thank us for cooperating with the police. He looked ill, hardly surprising. We'd boxed up her personal effects because we had a locum working out of her room. The police had already searched it. We put her personal effects together. There was hand cream and her framed degree certificate, and a photo of him, Roy, holding their daughter. He looked through the box and got a bit emotional, but then he picked up this thing that she'd had on her desk. It was one of those little wooden figures, like a Viking. He said, 'Where did this come from? Where did she get this?' None of us knew, but I thought he seemed upset by it. He probably thought a man had given it her. Of course, the police were looking into her love life by then. Awful thing, not to be able to trust your wife." Strike glanced up yet again at the house, saw no change, and flicked at the end of the book, which concluded in a final burst of speculation, supposition, and half-baked theory. On the one hand, Oakden implied that Margot had brought tragedy on herself, that fate had punished her for being too sexual and too bold, for cramming herself into a corset and bunny ears, for hoisting herself hubristically out of the class into which she had been born. On the other hand, she seemed to have lived her life surrounded by would-be killers. No man associated with Margot escaped Oakden's suspicion, whether it was charming but feckless Stevie Douthwaite turned Jax, domineering blood specialist Roy Phipps, resentful rapist Jules Bayliss, hot-tempered womanizer Paul Satchwell, or notorious sex monster Dennis Creed. Strike was on the edge of closing the book when he noticed a line of darker page edges in the middle, suggesting photographs, and opened it again. Other than the familiar press headshot and the picture of Margot and Una in their bunny girl costumes, Una curvaceous and grinning broadly, Margot statuesque, with a cloud of fair hair, there were only three photos. All were of poor quality, and featured Margot only incidentally. The first was captioned, "The author, his mother, and Margot." Square-jawed, iron-grey-haired, and wearing winged glasses, Dorothy Oakden stood facing the camera with her arm around a skinny, freckle-faced boy with a pageboy haircut, who had screwed up his face into a grimace that distorted his features. Strike was reminded of Luke, his eldest nephew. Behind the Oakdens was a long expanse of striped lawn, and in the distance, a sprawling house with many pointed gables. Objects appeared to be protruding out of the lawn close to the house. Upon closer examination, Strike concluded that they were the beginnings of walls or columns. It looked as though a summer house was under construction. Walking across the lawn behind Dorothy and Carl, unaware that she was being photographed, was Margot Bamborough, barefooted, wearing denim shorts and a T-shirt, carrying a plate and smiling at somebody out of shot. Strike deduced that this picture had been taken at the staff barbecue Margot had organized. The Phipps house was certainly grander than he'd imagined. After looking up once more to check that SB's car remained parked where he'd left it, Strike turned to the last two pictures, both of which featured the St. John's practice Christmas party. Tinsel had been draped over the reception desk and the waiting room cleared of chairs, which had been stacked in corners. Strike searched for Margot in both pictures, and found her, baby Anna in her arms, talking to a tall black woman he assumed was Wilma Bayliss. In the corner of the picture was a slim, round-eyed woman with feathered brown hair, who Strike thought might be a young Janice. In the second picture, all heads were turned away from the camera, or partially obscured, except one. A gaunt, unsmiling older man, in a suit, with his hair slicked back, was the only person who seemed to have been given notice that the picture was about to be taken. The flash had turned his eyes red. The picture was captioned, "Margot and Dr. Joseph Brenner," though only the back of Margot's head was visible. In the corner of this picture were three men who, judging from their coats and jackets, had just arrived at the party. The darkness of their clothing made a solid block of black on the right-hand side of the photo. All had their backs to the camera, but the largest, whose face was slightly turned to the left, displayed one long black sideburn, a large ear, the tip of a fleshy nose, and a drooping eye. His left hand was raised in the act of scratching his face. He was wearing a large gold ring featuring a lion's head. Strike examined this picture until noises out in the street made him look up. S.B. had just emerged from the house. A plump blonde in carpet slippers was standing on her doormat. She raised a hand and patted S.B. gently on the top of the head, as you would pet a child or a dog. Smiling, S.B. bade her farewell, then turned and walked back towards his Mercedes. Strike threw the copy of Whatever Happened to Margot Bamborough into the passenger seat. Waiting for S.B. to pull out into the road, he set off in pursuit. After 5 minutes or so, it became clear that his quarry was driving back to his home in West Brompton. One hand on the steering wheel, Strike groped for his mobile, then pressed the number of an old friend. The call went straight to voicemail.
"Shanker, it's Bunsen. Need to talk to you about something. Let me know when I can buy you a pint."
Chapter 26. All were fair knights and goodly well beseen, but to fair Britomart they all but shadows been. Edmund Spenser, The Faerie Queen. With 5 active cases on the agency's books, and only 4 days to go until Christmas, 2 of the agency's subcontractors succumbed to seasonal flu. Morris fell first. He blamed his daughter's nursery, where the virus had swept like wildfire through toddlers and parents alike. He continued to work until a high temperature and joint pain forced him to telephone in his apologies, by which time he'd managed to pass the bug to a furious Barclay, who in turn had transmitted it to his own wife and young daughter.
"Stupid arsehole should have stayed at home instead of breathing all over me in the car,"
Barclay ranted hoarsely over the phone to Strike, early on the morning of the 20th, while Strike was opening up the office. The last full team meeting before Christmas was to have taken place at 10 o'clock, but as 2 of the team were now unable to attend, Strike had decided to cancel. The only person he hadn't been able to reach was Robin, who he assumed was on the tube. Strike had asked her to come in early, so they could catch up with the Bamborough case before everyone else arrived.
"We're supposed to be flying to Glasgow the morrow,"
Barclay rasped, while Strike put on the kettle.
"The wind's in that much pain with our ears."
"Yeah," said Strike, who was feeling substandard himself, doubtless due to tiredness and too much smoking.
"Well, feel better and get back whenever you can."
"Arsehole,"
growled Barclay, and then,
"Morris, I mean, not you. Merry fucking Christmas."
Trying to convince himself that he was imagining the tickle in his throat, the slight clamminess of his back and the pain behind his eyes, Strike made himself a mug of tea, then moved through to the inner office and pulled up the blinds. Wind and heavy rain were causing the Christmas lights strung across Denmark Street to sway on their cables, just as they'd done on the 5 previous mornings. The decorations reminded Strike that he still hadn't started his Christmas shopping. He took a seat on his accustomed side of the partner's desk, knowing that he'd now left the job so late that he would be forced to execute it within a couple of hours, which at least obviated the tedious preliminary of carefully considering what anyone might like. Rain lashed the window behind him. He'd have liked to go back to bed. He heard the glass door open and close.
"Morning,"
Robin called from the outer office.
"It's vile out there."
"Morning,"
Strike called back.
"Kettle's just boiled and team meeting's cancelled. That's Barclay down with flu as well."
"Shit," said Robin. "How are you feeling?"
"Fine," said Strike, now sorting out his various Bamborough notes.
But when Robin entered the inner office, carrying tea in one hand and her own notebook in the other, she didn't think Strike looked fine at all. He was paler than usual. His forehead looked shiny, and there were grey shadows around his eyes. She closed the office door and sat down opposite him without passing comment.
"Not much point to a team meeting anyway," muttered Strike. "Fuck all progress on any of the cases. Twinkletoes is clean. The worst you can say about him is he's with her for the money, but her dad knew that from the start. Two times girlfriend isn't cheating, and Christ only knows what Shifty's got on SB. You saw my email about the blonde in Stoke Newington?
Yes, said Robin, whose face had been whipped into high colour by the squally weather. She was trying to comb her hair back into some semblance of tidiness with her fingers. Nothing come up on the address?
No. If I had to guess, I'd say she's a relative.
She patted him on the head as he left. Dominatrix? Suggested Robin. There wasn't much she hadn't learned about the kinks of powerful men since joining the agency.
It occurred to me, but the way he said goodbye, they looked cosy. But he hasn't got a sister and she looked younger than him. Would cousins pat each other on the head?
Well, Sunday night's all wrong for a normal counsellor or a therapist, but patting's quasi-parental. Life coach? Psychic?
That's a thought, said Strike, stroking his chin. Stockholders wouldn't be impressed if he's making business decisions based on what his fortune teller in Stoke Newington's telling him. I was going to put Morris onto the woman over Christmas, but he's out of action. Hutches is on two times girl, and I'm supposed to be leaving for Cornwall day after tomorrow. You're off to Masham. When? Tuesday?
No, said Robin, looking anxious. Tomorrow, Saturday. We did discuss this back in September, remember? I swapped with Morris so I could...
Yeah, I remember, lied Strike.
His head was starting to throb, and the tea wasn't making his throat feel much more comfortable.
No problem.
But this, of course, meant that if he was going to give Robin a Christmas present, he'd have to buy it and get it to her by the end of the day. I'd try and get a later train, said Robin, but obviously with it being Christmas...
No, your old time off, he said brusquely. You shouldn't be working just because those careless bastards got flu.
Robin, who had a strong suspicion that Barclay and Morris weren't the only people in the agency with flu, said, Do you want more tea?
What? No, said Strike, feeling unreasonably resentful at her for, as he saw it, forcing him to go shopping. And postcards are washout. We've got literally nothing.
I might have something on postcard.
What? Said Strike, surprised.
Our weatherman got another postcard yesterday, sent to the television studio. It's the fourth one bought in the National Portrait Gallery shop, and it's got an odd message on it. She pulled the postcard from her bag and handed it over the desk to Strike. The picture on the front reproduced a self-portrait of Joshua Reynolds, his hand shading his eyes in the stereotypical pose of one staring at something indistinct. On the back was written, I hope I'm wrong, but I think you sent someone to my work holding some of my letters. Have you let someone else see them? I really hope you haven't. Were you trying to scare me? You act like you're so kind and down to earth, no airs and graces. I'd have thought you'd have the decency to come yourself if you've got something to say to me. If you don't understand this, ignore. Strike looked up at Robin.
Does this mean...
Robin explained that she'd bought the same three postcards that Postcard had previously sent from the gallery shop, then roamed the gallery's many rooms, holding the postcards so that they were visible to all the guides she passed, until an owlish woman in thick-lensed glasses had appeared to react at the sight of them and disappeared through a door marked Staff Only. I didn't tell you at the time, Robin said, because I thought I might have imagined it. And she also looked exactly like the kind of person I'd imagine Postcard to be. So I was worried I was doing a Talbot, chasing me old mad hunches.
But you're not off your rocker, are you? That was a bloody good idea, going at a sharp and this,
he brandished the postcard of the Reynolds,
suggests you hit the bullseye first throw.
I didn't manage to get a picture of her, said Robin, trying not to show how much pleasure Strike's praise had given her. But she was in room 8, and I can describe her. Big glasses, shorter than me, thick brown hair bobbed, probably 40-ish. Strike made a note of the description.
Might nip along there myself before I head for Cornwall, he said. Right, let's get on with Bamborough.
But before either could say another word, the phone rang in the outer office. Glad to have something to complain about, Strike glanced at his watch, heaved himself to his feet and said,
It's 9 o'clock. Pat should...
But even as he said it, they both heard the glass door open, Pat's unhurried tread, and then, in her usual rasping baritone,
"Cormoran Strike Detective Agency?"
Robin tried not to smile as Strike dropped back into his chair. There was a knock on the door, and Pat stuck her head inside.
"Morning. Got a Gregory Talbot on hold for you."
"Put him through," said Strike. "Please," he added, detecting a martial look in Pat's eye, "and close the door." She did so. A moment later, the phone rang on the partner's desk, and Strike switched it to speakerphone.
"Hi, Gregory. Strike here."
"Yes, hello," said Gregory, who sounded anxious.
"What can I do for you?"
Well, you know how we were clearing out the loft?"
"Yes,"
said Strike. "Well, yesterday I unpacked an old box," said Gregory, sounding tense, "and I found something hidden under Dad's commendations and his uniform."
"Not hidden?"
said a querulous female voice in the background.
"I didn't know it was there," said Gregory. "And now my mother—"
"Let me talk to him," said the woman in the background.
"My mother would like to talk to you,"
said Gregory, sounding exasperated. A defiant, elderly female voice replaced Gregory's.
"Is this Mr. Strike?"
"It is."
"Gregory's told you all about how the police treated Bill at the end?"
"Yes," said Strike.
"He could have kept working once he'd got treatment for his thyroid, but they didn't let him. He'd given them everything. The force was his life. Greg says he's given you Bill's notes."
"That's right," said Strike.
"Well, after Bill died, I found this can in a box in the shed, and it had the Creed mark on it. You've read the notes. You know Bill used a special symbol for Creed."
"Yes," said Strike.
"I couldn't take everything with me into sheltered accommodation. They give you virtually no storage space, so I put it into the boxes to go in Greg and Alice's attic. I quite forgot it was there until Greg started looking through his dad's things yesterday. The police have made it quite clear that they weren't interested in Bill's theories, but Greg says you are, so you should have it."
Gregory came back on the line. They heard movement that seemed to indicate that Gregory was moving away from his mother. A door closed. "It's a can containing a reel of old 16mm film," he told Strike, his mouth close to the receiver. "Mum doesn't know what's on there. I haven't got a camera to run it, but I've held it up a bit to the light, and it looks like a dirty movie. I was worried about putting it out for the bin men." Given that the Talbots were fostering children, Strike understood his qualms.
"If we give it to you, I wonder—"
"You'd rather we didn't say where we got it," Strike said, eyes on Robin's. "I can't see why we'd need to."
Robin noticed that he hadn't promised, but Gregory seemed happy.
"I'll drop it off then," he said. "I'm coming up west this afternoon, taking the twins to see Father Christmas."
When Gregory had rung off, Strike said,
"You notice the Talbots are still convinced, 40 years on—"
The phone rang in the outer office again.
"That Margot was killed by Creed. I think I know what the symbol on this can of film is going to be, because—"
Pat knocked on the door of the inner office.
"Fuck's sake,"
muttered Strike, whose throat was starting to burn.
"What?"
"Charming," said Pat coldly. "There's a Mr. Shanker on the line for you. It diverted from your mobile. He says you wanted to—"
"Yeah, I do," said Strike. "Transfer it back to my mobile, please," he added. And turning to Robin, he said, "Sorry, can you give me a moment?"
Robin left the room, closing the door behind her, and Strike pulled out his mobile.
"Shanker, hi. Thanks for getting back to me."
He and Shanker, whose real name he'd have been hard-pressed to remember, had known each other since they were teenagers. Their lives had been moving in diametrically different directions even then. Strike heading for university, army, and detective work, Shanker pursuing a career of ever-deepening criminality. Nevertheless, a strange sense of kinship had continued to unite them, and they were, occasionally, useful to each other. Strike paying Shanker in cash for information or services that he could get no other way.
"What's up, Bunsen?"
"I wanted to buy you a pint and show you a photo,"
said Strike.
Up your way later today, as it goes, going to Hamley's. Got the wrong fucking monster hideover for Sahara.
Everything except Hamley's had been gibberish to Strike.
Okay, call me when you're ready for a drink. Fair dues.
The line went dead. Shanker didn't tend to bother with goodbyes. Robin returned carrying two fresh mugs of tea and closed the door with her foot.
Sorry about that, said Strike,
absent-mindedly wiping sweat off his top lip.
What was I saying?
That you think you know what symbol's on Talbot's can of old film.
Oh, yeah, said Strike. Symbol for Capricorn. I've been having a go at deciphering these notes, he added,
tapping the leather-bound notebook sitting beside him. And he took Robin through the reasons Bill Talbot had come to believe that Margot had been abducted by a man born under the sign of the goat.
Talbot was ruling out suspects on the basis that they weren't Capricorns? Asked Robin in disbelief.
Yeah,
said Strike, frowning, his throat burning worse than ever. He took a sip of tea.
Except that Roy Phipps is a Capricorn, and Talbot ruled him out too.
Why?
I'm still trying to decipher it all. But he seems to have been using a weird symbol for Phipps that I haven't been able to identify on any astrological site so far. But the notes explain why he kept interviewing Janice. Her star sign's Cancer. Cancer is Capricorn's opposing sign, and Cancerians are psychic and intuitive, according to Talbot's notes. Talbot concluded that, as a Cancerian, Janice was his natural ally against Baphomet, and that she might have supernatural insights into Baphomet's identity, hence the dream diary. Even more significant in his mind was that Saturn, Capricorn's ruler...
Robin hid a smile behind her mug of tea. Strike's expression, as he outlined these astrological phenomena, would have been appropriate to a man asked to eat weeks-old seafood. Was in Cancer on the day of Margot's disappearance.
From this, Talbot deduced that Janice knew or had had contact with Baphomet. Hence the request for a list of her sexual partners.
Wow, said Robin quietly.
I'm just giving you a hint of the nuttery, but there's plenty more. I'll email you the important points when I finish deciphering it. But what's interesting is that there are hints of an actual detective trying to fight through his illness. He had the same idea that occurred to me, that Margot might have been lured somewhere on the pretext of someone needing medical assistance, although he dresses it all up in mumbo-jumbo. There was a stellium in the sixth house, the House of Health, which he decided meant danger associated with illness.
What's a stellium?
Group of more than three planets. The police did check out patients she'd seen a lot of in the run-up to the disappearance. There was Douthwaite, obviously, and a demented old woman on Gopsall Street, who kept ringing the surgery for something to do, and a family who lived on Herbal Hill, whose kid had had a reaction to his polio vaccination.
Doctors, said Robin, have contact with so many people.
Yeah, said Strike, and I think that's part of what went wrong in this case. Talbot took in a huge amount of information and couldn't see what to discard. On the other hand, the possibility of her being lured into a house on a medical pretext or attacked by an angry patient isn't crazy. Medics walk unaccompanied into all kinds of people's houses. And look at Douthwaite. Lawson really fancied him as Margot's abductor or killer. And Talbot was very interested in him too. Even though Douthwaite was a Pisces, Talbot tries to make him a Capricorn. He says Schmidt thinks Douthwaite's really a Capricorn.
Who's Schmidt?
No idea, said Strike. But he or she is all over the notes, correcting signs.
All the chances to get actual evidence lost, said Robin quietly, while Talbot was checking everyone's horoscope.
Exactly. It'd be funny if it wasn't so serious. But his interest in Douthwaite still smacks of sound copper instinct. Douthwaite seems pretty bloody fishy to me as well.
Ha-ha, said Robin.
Strike looked blank.
Pisces, she reminded him.
Oh, yeah, said Strike, unsmiling.
The throbbing behind his eyes was worse than ever, his throat complaining every time he swallowed, but he couldn't have flu. It was impossible. "I read that bit you marked in Ogden's book," he continued. "The stuff about Douthwaite changing his name when he went to Clacton to sing at a holiday camp. But I can't find any trace of a Steve, Stephen, or Stevie Jacks after 1976, either. One name change might be understandable after a lot of police attention. Two starts to look suspicious."
"You think?" said Robin. "We know he was a nervous type, judging from his medical records. Maybe he was spooked by Ogden turning up at Butlin's."
"But Ogden's book was pulped. Nobody beyond a couple of Butlin's redcoats ever knew Stevie Jacks had been questioned about Margot Bamborough."
"Maybe he went abroad," said Robin. "Died abroad. I'm starting to think that's what happened to Paul Satchwell as well. Did you see? Satchwell's ex-neighbour said he went off travelling."
"Yeah," said Strike. "Any luck on Gloria Conti yet?"
"Nothing," sighed Robin. "But I have got a couple of things," she went on, opening her notebook. "They don't advance us much, but for what they're worth. I've now spoken to Charlie Ramage's widow in Spain, the hot tub millionaire who thought he saw Margot in a Leamington Spa graveyard." Strike nodded, glad of a chance to rest his throat. "I think Mrs. Ramage has either had a stroke or likes a lunchtime drink. She sounded slurred, but she confirmed that Charlie thought he'd seen Margot in a graveyard, and that he discussed it afterwards with a policeman friend, whose name she couldn't remember. Then suddenly she said, 'No, wait, Mary Flanagan. It was Mary Flanagan he thought he saw.' I took her back over the story, and she said, 'Yes, that was all correct, except that it was Mary Flanagan, not Margot Bamborough, he thought he'd seen.' 'I've looked up Mary Flanagan,' said Robin, 'and she's been missing since 1959. It's Britain's longest ever missing person case.'"
"Which of them would you say seemed more confused?" asked Strike. "Mrs. Ramage or Janice?"
"Mrs. Ramage, definitely," said Robin. "Janice definitely wouldn't have confused the two women, would she? Whereas Mrs. Ramage might have done. She had no personal interest. To her, they were just two missing people whose names began with M."
Strike sat frowning, thinking it over. Finally, he said, his tonsils burning,
"If Ramage was a teller of tall tales generally, his policeman mate can't be blamed for not taking him seriously. This is at least confirmation that Ramage believed he'd once met a missing woman."
He frowned so intensely that Robin said, "Are you in pain?"
"No. I'm wondering whether it'd be worth trying to see Irene and Janice separately. I'd hope never to have to talk to Irene Hickson again. At the very least, we should keep looking for a connection between Margot and Leamington Spa. Did you say you had another lead?"
"Not much of one. Amanda Laws, or Amanda White, as she was when she supposedly saw Margot at that window on Clerkenwell Road, answered my email. I'll forward a reply if you want to read it, but basically she's angling for money."
"Is she now?"
"She dresses it up a bit. Says she told the police and nobody believed her. Told Ogden and he didn't give her a penny. And she's tired of not being taken seriously, and if we want her story, she'd like to be paid for it this time. She claims she's endured a lot of negative attention, being called a liar and a fantasist, and she's not prepared to go through all of that again unless she gets compensated."
Strike made a second note.
"Tell her it isn't the agency's practice to pay witnesses for their cooperation," said Strike. "Appeal to her better nature. If that doesn't work, she can have 100 quid.
"I think she's hoping for thousands."
"And I'm hoping for Christmas in the Bahamas," said Strike, as rain dotted the window behind him. "That all you've got?"
"Yes," said Robin, closing her notebook.
"Well, I've drawn a blank on the Benny-abusing patient who claimed to have killed Margot. Applethorpe. I think Irene must have got the name wrong. I've tried all the variants that have occurred to me, but nothing's coming up. I might have to call her back. I'll try Janice first, though."
"You haven't told me what you thought of the Ogden book."
"Bog-standard opportunist," said Strike, "who did well to squeeze 10 chapters out of virtually nothing. but I'd like to track him down if we can.
I'm trying, sighed Robin, but he's another one who seems to have vanished off the face of the planet. His mother seemed to be his primary source, didn't she? I don't think he persuaded anyone who really knew Margot to talk to him.
No, said Strike. You'd highlighted nearly all the interesting bits.
Nearly, said Robin sharply.
All, Strike corrected himself.
You spotted something else?
No, said Strike. But seeing that she was unconvinced, he added, I've just been wondering whether someone might have put a hit on her.
Her husband? Said Robin, startled.
Maybe, said Strike.
Or are you thinking about the cleaner's husband, Jules Bayliss, and his alleged criminal connections?
Not really.
Then why?
I just keep coming back to the fact that if she was killed, it was done very efficiently. Which might suggest
a contract killer, said Robin. You know, I read a biography of Lord Lucan recently. They think he hired someone to kill his wife.
And the killer got the nanny by mistake, said Strike, who was familiar with the theory. Yeah. Well, if that's what happened to Margot, we're looking at an assassin a damn sight more efficient than Lucan's. Not a trace of her left behind. Not so much as a drop of blood.
There was a momentary silence while Strike glanced behind him to see the rain and wind still buffeting the Christmas lights outside, and Robin's thoughts flew to Roy Phipps, the man whom Una had called bloodless, conveniently bedridden, on the day of Margot's disappearance.
"Well, I need to get going," said Strike, pushing himself up out of his chair.
"I should too," sighed Robin, collecting her things.
"You're coming back into the office later, though?" Strike asked.
He needed to give her the as-yet-unbought Christmas present before she left for Yorkshire. "I wasn't planning to," said Robin. "Why?"
"Come back in," Strike said, trying to think of a reason.
He opened the door into the outer office.
"Pat?"
"Yes,"
said Pat, without looking round. She was once more typing fast and accurately, her electronic cigarette waggling between her teeth.
"Robin and I both need a head out now, but a man called Gregory Talbot's about to drop off a can of 16mm film. Do you think you can track down a projector that'll play it? Ideally before 5 o'clock.
Pat swung slowly around on her desk chair to look at Strike, her monkeyish face set, her eyes narrowed.
You want me to find a vintage film projector by 5 o'clock?
That's what I said. Strike turned to Robin. Then we can have a quick look at whatever Talbot had hiding in the attic before you leave for Masham.
Okay, said Robin. I'll come back at 4.
Chapter 27. His name was Talus, made of iron mould, immovable, resistless, without end, who in his hand an iron flail did hold, with which he threshed out falsehood and did truth unfold. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Some 2.5 hours later, Strike stood beneath the awning of Hamley's on Regent Street, shopping bags by his feet, telling himself firmly that he was fine, in spite of ample empirical evidence that he was, in fact, shivering. Cold rain was spattering all around him onto the dirty pavements, where it was kicked out of puddles by the marching feet of hundreds of passing pedestrians. It splashed over curbs in the wake of passing vehicles and dripped down the back of Strike's collar, though he stood, theoretically, beneath shelter. While checking his phone yet again for some sign that Shanker hadn't forgotten they were supposed to be meeting for a drink, he lit a cigarette, but his raw throat didn't appreciate the sudden ingestion of smoke. With a foul taste in his mouth, he ground out the cigarette after one drag. There was no message from Shanker, so Strike picked up his bulky shopping bags and set off again, his throat burning every time he swallowed. He'd imagined, optimistically, that he might have finished all his shopping within 2 hours, but midday had come and gone, and he still wasn't done. How did people decide what to buy when the speakers were all shrieking Christmas tunes at you, and the shops were full of too much choice, and all of it looked like junk? Endless processions of women kept ranging across his path, choosing items with apparently effortless ease.
Were they genetically programmed to seek and find the right gift? Was there nobody he could pay to do this for him? His eyes felt heavy, his throat ached, and his nose had started running. Unsure where he was going or what he was looking for, he walked blindly onwards. He, who usually had an excellent sense of direction, kept turning the wrong way, becoming disorientated. Several times he knocked into carefully stacked piles of Christmas merchandise or buffeted smaller people, who scowled and muttered and scurried away. The bulky bags he was carrying contained three identical Nerf blasters for his nephews, large plastic guns which shot foam bullets, which Strike had decided to buy on the dual grounds that he would have loved one when he was 11, and the assistant had assured him they were one of the must-have gifts of the year. He'd bought his Uncle Ted a sweater, because he couldn't think of anything else, his brother-in-law a box of golf balls and a bottle of gin on the same principle, but he still had the trickiest gifts to buy. The ones for the women, Lucy, Joan, and Robin. His mobile rang. Fuck. He hobbled sideways out of the crowd, and standing behind a mannequin wearing a reindeer sweater, shook himself free from a few of his bags so that he could pull out his mobile.
Strike.
Banson, I'm near Shakespeare's Head on Great Marlborough Street. See you there in 20.
Great,
said Strike, who was becoming hoarse.
I'm just round the corner.
Another wave of sweat passed over him, soaking scalp and chest. It was, some part of his brain acknowledged, just possible that he had caught Barclay's flu, and if that was the case, he mustn't give it to his severely immunosuppressed aunt. He picked up his shopping bags again and made his way back to the slippery pavement outside. The black-and-white timbered frontage of Liberty rose up to his right as he headed along Great Marlborough Street. Buckets and boxes of flowers lay all around the main entrance, temptingly light and portable, and already wrapped, so easy to carry to the Shakespeare's Head and take on to the office afterwards. But, of course, flowers wouldn't do this time. Sweating worse than ever, Strike turned into the store, dumped his bags once more on the floor beside an array of silk scarves, and called Isla.
"Hey, Oggy," said Isla.
"What can I get Robin for Christmas?"
he said. It was becoming difficult to talk. His throat felt raw.
"Are you all right?"
"I'm fantastic. Give me an idea. I'm in Liberty."
Said Isla.
Oh, I know what you can get her. She wants some new perfume. She didn't like the stuff.
I don't need a backstory," said Strike ungraciously. "That's great. Perfume. What does she wear?"
"I'm trying to tell you, Oggy," said Isla. "She wants a change. Choose her something new."
"I can't smell," said Strike impatiently. "I've got a cold."
But this basic problem aside, he was afraid that a perfume he'd personally picked out was too intimate a gift, like that green dress of a few years back. He was looking for something like flowers, but not flowers. Something that said, "I like you," but not, "This is what I'd like you to smell like."
"Just go to an assistant and say, 'I want to buy a perfume for someone who wears Philopsychos, but wants a—'"
"She what?" said Strike. "She wears what?"
"Philopsychos."
"Oh, she did."
"Spell it," said Strike, his head thumping. Isla did so.
"So I just ask an assistant and they'll give me something like it."
"That's the idea," said Isla patiently.
"Great," said Strike. "Appreciate it. Speak soon." "The assistant thought you'd like it." "Yeah, he'd say that." "The assistant thought you'd like it" would effectively depersonalize the gift, turn it into something almost as mundane as flowers, but it would still show he'd taken some care, given it some thought.
Picking up his carrier bags again, he limped towards an area he could see in the distance that looked as though it was lined with bottles. The perfume department turned out to be small, about the size of Strike's office. He sidled into the crowded place, passing beneath a cupola painted with stars, to find himself surrounded by shelves laden with fragile cargoes of glass bottles, some of which wore ruffs or patterns like lace, others which looked like jewels or the kind of file suitable for a love potion. apologising as he forced people aside with his Nerf guns, his gin and his golf balls. He met a slim, black-clad man who asked, "Can I help you?" At this moment, Strike's eye fell on a range of bottled scents, which were identically packed with black labels and tops. They looked functional and discreet, with no overt suggestion of romance.
"I'd like one of those,"
he croaked, pointing.
"Right," said the assistant.
"It's for someone who used to wear Philosykos, something like that."
"Okay," said the assistant, leading Strike over to the display.
"Well, what about—"
"No," said Strike, before the assistant could remove the top of the tester. The perfume was called Carnal Flower.
"She said she didn't like that one,"
Strike added, with the conscious aim of appearing less strange.
"Are any of the others like Philo—"
"She might like Dans tes bras," suggested the assistant, spraying a second bottle onto a smelling strip.
"Doesn't that mean—"
"In your arms," said the assistant.
"No,"
said Strike, without taking the smelling strip.
"Are any of the others like Fate
Musc Ravageur?"
"You know what? I'll leave it,"
said Strike, sweat prickling anew beneath his shirt.
"Which exit is the nearest to Shakespeare's head?"
The unsmiling assistant pointed Strike towards the left. Muttering apologies, Strike edged back out past women who were studying bottles and spraying on testers, turned a corner and saw, with relief, the pub where he was meeting Shanker, which lay just beyond the glass doors of a room full of chocolates.
"Chocolates," he thought,
slowing down and incidentally impeding a group of harried women.
"Everyone likes chocolates."
Sweat was now coming over him in waves, and he seemed to feel simultaneously hot and cold. He approached a table piled high with chocolate boxes, looking for the most expensive one, one that would show appreciation and friendship. Trying to choose a flavour, he thought he recalled a conversation about salted caramel, so he took the largest box he could find and headed for the till. 5 minutes later, another bag hanging from his hands, Strike emerged at the end of Carnaby Street, where music-themed Christmas decorations hung between buildings. In Strike's now fevered state, the invisible head suggested by giant headphones and sunglasses seemed sinister rather than festive. Struggling with his bags, he backed into the Shakespeare's head, where fairy lights twinkled and chatter and laughter filled the air.
"Banson!"
said a voice just inside the door. Shanker had secured a table. Shaven-headed, gaunt, pale and heavily tattooed, Shanker had an upper lip that was fixed in a permanent Elvis-style sneer, due to the scar that ran up towards his cheekbone. He was absent-mindedly clicking the fingers of the hand not holding his pint, a tic he'd had since his teens. No matter where he was, Shanker managed to emanate an aura of danger, projecting the idea that he might, on the slightest provocation, resort to violence. Crowded as the pub was, nobody had chosen to share his table. Incongruously, or so it seemed to Strike, Shanker too had shopping bags at his feet.
"What's wrong with you?"
Shanker said, as Strike sank down opposite him and disposed of his own bags beneath the table.
"You look like shit."
"Nothing," said Strike,
whose nose was now running profusely and whose pulse seemed to have become erratic.
"Cold or something."
"Well, keep it the fuck away from me,"
said Shanker.
"Last thing we fucking need at home. Zahara's only just got over the fucking flu. Want a pint?"
No,
said Strike. The thought of beer was currently repellent.
"Couldn't get me some water, could you?"
"Fuck's sake," muttered Shanker as he got up. When Shanker had returned with a glass of water and sat down again, Strike said, without preamble,
"I wanted to ask you about an evening. Must have been round about 92, 93. You needed to get into town. You had a car, but you couldn't drive it yourself. You'd done something to your arm. It was strapped up."
Shanker shrugged impatiently, as much to say, who could be expected to remember something so trivial? Shanker's life had been an endless series of injuries received and inflicted, and of needing to get places to deliver cash, drugs,